prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom. I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen, bringing you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for Thursday, October 26, 2023. Good afternoon, Dave.
Good afternoon, Melody. And hey, happy National Financial Crime Fighter Day.
That's fun.
How about that? I mean, technically, it recognizes the Bank Secrecy Act and the anti-money laundering professionals that work to try and keep the system honest.
Yeah, that's a joke.
I think that is
that's a joke. That's
up
a,
for debate. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, that's
well,
a joke.
On the heels of the drug wars of the 60s and 70s and all the illegal money entering the U.S., oh boy, funding more criminal activity, including drug and human trafficking. Congress passed the so-called BSA, the Bank Secrecy Act, in 1970 to create better anti-money laundering efforts. And, well, here's one they, I'd like to see their annual report to prevent financing of criminal activities following the terrorist attacks on September 11th, 2001, 30 years later. Congress did reinforce the BSA by passing the controversial Patriot Act, which cemented the critical role of today's professionals. There you have it, Melody.
Yeah, well.
Happy day, nevertheless.
Yeah. Like that has worked out well. So anyway.
Yes. Just ask Jamie Dimon.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Let's go ahead and see what gold has done today. It's off the high of 1990. We're still looking at the New York spot price market, 1985, up $4. Silver is down a little bit, $22.82, down 13 cents. Platinum was down $4.912. Palladium was up 8 at 1,158. The USDX today was stronger by 0.12 at 106.65. Crude oil was down another $2 at 83.47. And I round these numbers out, so 83.47. The stock market today, the Dow was down, still under 1%, 251 points. The S&P was down over 1%, almost 1.25%, and the NASDAQ was down 1.75%. So the NASDAQ's been getting hit hard here in the last couple of days, and it stands at 12,595. Asian markets, they were all negative. China was up, you know, whole 14 points, which is almost a half a percent. But European markets were all negative. 10-year yield still holding at the 4.8 something level, but it was down a little bit lower today, all based on the silly, crazy, stupid GDP number that we're going to talk about here shortly. Natural gas was stronger, almost 8% at 3.24. So that is certainly stronger. And, you know, we talked a little bit about this on Tuesday about the GDP, what people were expecting and estimating. And, you know, 4.9% in the third quarter. It's like, really? The GDP grew at 5%, basically, annualized rate over the third quarter, up more than double the 2.1% rate in the second quarter. So what really changed from the second quarter to the third quarter? Now, supposedly all due to consumer spending. Consumers hiked spending on services like medical appointments. Well, that's not by choice, I wouldn't think. What about dinners out, spending money out on dinners? Cars? And if you have more of those medical appointments, then you need to buy more drugs. So prescription drugs. And of course, we can't forget government spending. Can't forget about them. They're good at it. So it's like we have personal savings that fell during the third quarter. The share of disposable income put away as savings stood at 3.8%, down 27% from 5.2% in the second quarter. So I didn't know people had any savings because they've been using their credit cards for necessities. So are they going to throw all caution to the wind and just splurge and do whatever is necessary? You think so, Dave? I don't know. So in keeping with the spending blitz, personal savings, as I just mentioned, you know, is this going to push the Fed to rate hikes at the meeting next week? Yeah, probably. And again, I'm at the point where, you know what? It doesn't even really matter anymore. Powell said last week at a luncheon that the unexpectedly strong economic performance in recent months, it's pretty much almost a given that he's going to have to put a rate increase, because if their inflation is all based on supply and demand, on economic growth, well, yeah, they're going to have to raise rates and keep doing it. So, you know, it's kind of interesting to view whether, so you got the government fighting with the Fed. The government keeps coming out with these reports that goes against what the Fed is trying to accomplish. So they're worst enemies. But anyway, it's really kind of, you know, kind of silly.
Like that, I just got a picture of that old scene oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm forgetting the Chinatown, the old Jack Nicholas Faye Dunaway movie, where Nicholson has Dunaway in his grasps, and she's confessing that her father's the child of her baby. But in this particular case, it's monetary policy, slap. No, it's fiscal policy, slap. No, it's monetary policy.
Yeah, I know. It's just, you know, they're just fighting with one another. So it's just with what they're, so, I mean. And, you know, I mean, we're already getting, usually the the fibs don't start until the actual election year. But I think they've started a little early. But anyway, that's what I believe.
Round the clock fibbing.
You know, I mean, I didn't see the percentages of what the various funds have gone into. Like, you know, was the medical, you know, the biggest contributor to a higher GDP. And I think also, Dave, it'd be good to break down, you know, what makes up the GDP as far as the little pie, you know, the various sectors and who is doing the onset. So I don't see doctoring and prescriptions as a good economy. Government spending, I don't look at it as a good economy. To me, that's not what equals a great GDP, because there's no manufacturing or creation of anything. So,
Yeah. Well, you got the four components. Broad components are the personal consumption expenditures, like you've been talking about, and the durable goods and non-durable goods, like clothing, food, gas, what have you, and then services like banking, healthcare, education. But there's also business investment, fixed investment, and change in private inventory. And of course, government spending, not just federal government, but obviously a huge part of it, but also state and local government spending. Combined, it's a lot of goings on out there. And then, of course, exports, net exports of goods and services.
Which we're in a hole. So.
Yeah, which, you know, they ought to say net imports.
Yeah.
And services.
So, yeah, the GDP might be 4.9%, but how good really is that number when you break it down and see what it consists of and what the big showings are? So just keep that in mind when you hear people gloat over the next few days of what a great GDP that we have. So, the onset of some of the financial pain is exemplified by the housing market. We talk about this all the time, where we see 30-year mixed mortgages reaching 8% last week. And we certainly know that has slowed the housing market. And home sellers have opted to stay put with mortgages that have been locked in at, you know, still some of those comparatively low rates. Mortgage applications have fallen to their lowest level since 1996. The Mortgage Brokers Association had said earlier this month. And the housing industry should voice a very profound concern about these mortgage rates rising. They did profess that last week in a letter that kind of urged the Fed to stop hiking its benchmark interest rates. So, you know, these individual industries, they don't give a hoot about what's going on in the economy. They're only giving a hoot about what's happening in their industry and asking the Fed to. I think that is lobbying, Dave.
The Fed?
Gosh. So, anyway.
Yeah, well, you know, it's pretty crazy out there. You do have mortgage applications falling to their lowest level since 1996.
Right.
And now you have everyone asking, as you alluded to, pardon me, you know, what's the Fed going to do next? Will this report force the Fed's hand? I mean, as of this morning, you have a huge majority, 98% of Fed fund future traders saying no action. This Fed will stand pat, keep things where they are in November, and even 80% believe right now that they won't do anything in December either. In fact, it's not until next June a majority of traders see the Fed starting to loosen policy by lowering rates. Very few in the marketplace believe the Fed or believe Powell, when I wonder why, when he keeps hinting at another increase next week or next month. We shall see.
Well, inflation isn't going away. Inflation is here to stay. And, you know, they have Treasury bond issuance. You know, that's going to, they're talking about it reaching a record high in 2024 as we continue to see these interest rates go higher. And it will aggravate the government's budget deficits. This is all out from the too big to fail Bank of America. So, you know, that prompted the analysts to raise their estimates. And that's all these are, folks, is estimates. I've seen a lot of these estimates. They'll either estimate too high and then they'll exceed and then everybody gets patted. It's really a joke, or they keep their estimates low just for so an industry or, you know, a corporation can beat them and everything is high. I would never base my decisions on estimates, on people's and governments, based on government's estimates or analysts' estimates. But anyway, they're looking to have a supply of 10-year equivalents to be around $1.34 trillion or $90 billion higher than what they had previous estimated. And I do believe the higher rates will have a meaningful impact on deficit spending and result in larger issuance. It's creating a spiral effect. But we'll just have to see what happens next year. And I don't think anybody can really predict what's going to happen next year. I think next year in 2024 is just going to be a toss-up, because I don't think anything is going to be a smooth ride in 2024. So, but that's all I think, Dave. What do you say?
Well, it's a Washington election year coming up. So indeed, all bets with many things, anything political in particular, will be off. Even though we can say that the House has elected a new Speaker of the House, I don't think that'll have much impact on policymaking at all, given the current divisions. The current skepticism among the American electorate. But we will see. I mean, the Treasury's debt market right now is $26 trillion debt held by the public. The Bank of America folks say that, you know, they think that auction sizes are going to be continue to increase. Again, as Melody suggested, who knows, especially the 7-year and 20-year maturities. Treasury issuance is expected to push the 10-year bond supply to an all-time high next year. And Congress is not going to rein in deficits and debt. The economy could help a little bit here and there with deficits. What's the song? More, more, more. How do you like it? How do you like it? More, more, more. Yes, yeah, deficits money. Yeah. And debt.
Yeah, they can't cut back. I mean, our whole system is based on them creating debt, not cutting back on it.
Well, growing supply, too, could continue to put upward pressure on yields. 16-year highs, over 5% now with the 10-year yield. That's supply-demand imbalance. Set off alarms for, big investors. That if the Treasury starts to have a hard time finding buyers for all of our debt, that's just another factor that's going to put pressure to increase rates in the secondary market.
And, you know, it's interesting. And all these markets and all these numbers is as if everything stays the same. Right. And there isn't anything that's going to stay the same next year. So, also, what's not going to stay the same is a longer segment because we're heading into a break. We'll be right back.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home. And if you ask me how I'm feeling, don't tell me you're too blind to see. Never gonna give you up, never gonna let you down, never gonna run around and desert you, never gonna make you cry, never gonna say goodbye, never gonna tell a lie and hurt you, never gonna give you up, never gonna let you down.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cederstrom. I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com, and make sure you sign up for our weekly newsletter and the blog that is produced and edited by our very own Dave Allen. So, Just real quick, jobless claims, hey, they rose by 10,000 to 210 for the week ending October 21st. I don't think there's too much in here that we need to talk about other than that. Do you see anything else in there that we needed to add other than that?
Nope.
And well, heading into the break, we were talking a lot about interest rates and the ECB, the European Central Bank. They ended its run of interest rate hikes today, despite new upside risks to inflation, mainly from the oil markets and, of course, the Israel war. So their key rate maintained at a record high of only 4%. And they had 10 consecutive hikes. And we'll see if they're pausing once, but I doubt they're going to be able to stay at this level. So we'll see. And they don't have as big as issues as we have. So I guess it's all relative, but anything
we
else?
We see a lot of the same words coming out of Christine Lagarde's
of course.
mouth, ECB president, as we do Jay Powell and other central bank chairs, you know, with words like, you know, remaining data dependent and fighting our resoluteness and fighting inflation. The one big difference that perhaps the only difference I saw is Lagarde saying now's not the time for any forward. Give the Fed a little credit where credit's due. I mean, there is some level of forward guidance here. It gives the markets, investors, somewhat of a clue. I mean, through their periodic dot plots and revised economic projections. But again, be cautious. As Melody said in the first segment, I won't be too sure about these estimates' accuracy, because they tend to be off on a frequent basis.
Well, you know, it is really pathetic, though. It'll be interesting to see what the revisions are going to be for the next two GDPs when they release the revisions on this third quarter, just to see how low they go. I don't know if they revised the second quarter GDP in any direction, or they're just using the one.
But no, I think they're done with the second quarter revisions.
Yeah, because they're able to do it three times, adjust the number three times. So let's go ahead. This is interesting. I'm glad you brought this up, because I think we're going to be changing our clocks pretty soon. And not cleaning our clocks, but changing our clocks. And
yeah, the Fed will do that enough for us.
Yeah. And I mean, about 2 years ago, it was just like everybody was quite sure that it was going to be eliminated. And it's like, no, 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 no. There's so much disinformation about this. So why don't you tell us about daylight savings time, Dave?
Well, Melody, you know the old adage, spring forward, fall back. Yeah, it seems that each time this year, things change, the clocks in particular. Discussion on making daylight saving time permanent comes to the forefront. Now, the idea to end the clock changing was put before Congress in the last couple of years. The U.S. Senate unanimously approved the Sunshine Protection Act last year, a bill that would have made daylight saving time permanent. Although the bill to protect sunshine was passed unanimously there, the law didn't pass in the House and thus didn't become law. The 2023 version of that same act has remained idle in both houses so far this year. And now that it's about to end, unless there's bipartisan agreement by next weekend, it most likely won't happen for at least another 6 months. In any event, a version of the modern daylight saving time that we observe today was first proposed by my wife's distant cousin, Ben Franklin, in 1784, in a satirical essay to the editor of the Journal of Paris. In his essay, Ben suggested that Parisians could save money on candles and lamp oil by just changing their sleep schedules. Go to bed an hour earlier, or go to bed an hour later, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, nothing came of Franklin's proposal. Daylight savings time, in fact, was first implemented in the U.S. anyway in 1918 during World War I with the Standard Time Act, which added more daylight hours to conserve energy, which is a big thing then. Under the Standard Time Act, clocks would move forward an hour on the last Sunday of March and move back an hour on the last Sunday of October. And it also established the five time zones across the U.S. Well, the Uniform Time Act of 1966 established daylight saving time more systematically throughout the country, even though today it's not observed in every state or territory. I hadn't known that until I read this. 1974, a law signed by President Nixon created year-round daylight saving time in order to save fuel during that national gas crisis. However, the early morning darkness caused some accidents for children going to school, and the Watergate scandal moved Nixon out of office just a few months later. So an amendment was introduced 7 days after Nixon's resignation to end his daylight savings time experiment. It was signed into law by President Gerald Ford a month later. Anyway, Hawaii and Arizona, well, Arizona except for the Navajo Nation, don't observe daylight saving time. Neither do the U.S. territories of American Samoa, Guam, Northern Mariana Islands, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. And worldwide, only about 70 of the close to 200 countries use daylight savings time. Japan, India, China, as well as most countries near the equator do not have it, nor does Russia and its mammoth 11 time zones. But virtually every country in the EU does. So do New Zealand and most of Australia. And they also use it in Israel, Palestine, Lebanon, and Egypt. They also do in most of Canada, South America, Canada, and Paraguay, and most of Chile, plus most island nations in the Caribbean. Bottom line, next Sunday, November 5, 2 a.m. local time, we'll once again travel back in time, 1 hour. Actually, just our clocks will, and we'll gain an hour of sleep that night. Then next March, daylight savings time will begin again. When we set our clocks forward, lose an hour of sleep on that Sunday, and blah, 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 blah. Me, Melody, I wish we had DST year-round, but understand, if you're a farmer or the parent of a child who walks to school, you probably like the change. In any event, that's this week's Liberty is Golden.
I'm not sure there's any child that walks to school anymore.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, and I don't think they can change it because I don't know how it would affect everything else, considering we're so globally with times, and I don't think they can. I don't think because all the computers are adapting to all of the daylight savings to vary, you know, so I don't think they can eliminate it at this point in time. I don't, unless everybody did. But I don't know. It's interesting that you have the European nations and our nation, you know, so I don't know. Maybe I'm overthinking it, but anyway, I guess this was a little bit of good news. You had the United Auto Workers Union. They've reached a tentative contract with Ford. So that strike was nearly 6 weeks long, and they reached a 4-year deal. Now, it still has to be approved by 57,000 union members at the company, but it could bring a close to the strike. You still have, I guess, no deal has been created with General Motors or Stellantis, who makes the Jeep. But the UAW VP Chuck Browning, who was the chief negotiator with Ford, said that the workers are going to get a 25% general wage increase plus cost of living raises. Excuse me, that will put the pay increase over 30% to above $40 per hour for top scale assembly plant workers by the end of the contract. So again, I don't know if I said it, but it's a 4-year contract, I believe. Right, Dave? I believe. Assembly workers will get 11% upon ratification, almost equal to all of the wage increases that workers had since 2007. So, but GM and Stellantis says, hey, we're working on it. So we'll get back to you.
Yeah, sorry. I have a muted microphone during your talking, so I can cough.
Oh, that's fine.
A lot of hacking going on. Normally, you know, one company settles with the UAW, the other companies follow pretty much, not completely, but pretty much in lockstep. So I'm looking for the other two companies to come to similar agreements in probably within the next week, even. Meantime, Sean Fain, the UAW prez, encouraging workers at Ford plants to head back to work. Workers are also going to get increased pension benefits, 401k company contribution. Oh, gosh, sorry. For the first time, the union will have the right to go on strike over any company plans to close factories, which is very interesting. I'm surprised to see that particular piece of it. In any event, go ahead.
No, it's kind of interesting because, I mean, they didn't get their 40% and increase it. Weren't they looking for a 40% increase? So
yeah, initially they wanted 40. The companies were talking about 23. So it's not too far off the 23. I guess they're looking
for so
the other sweeteners. And I'm sure they didn't get the four day work week.
So it looked like you ask for the stars and you ask for the moon and hopefully you get something close to it. So
there you got it.
Yeah. Prime Minister of the UK is warning of the risks of artificial intelligence ahead of a summit in which the UK hopes to take a global role in shaping how safely around the technology is designed. I think they're a little too late, but anyway. He said that AI will bring a transformation as far-reaching as the Industrial Revolution, the coming of electricity, or the birth of the Internet, while adding that there are risks attached to that proposition. He said the AI could make it easier to build chemical or biological weapons, and that criminals could exploit that technology. Hey, buddy, have you been to the dark web lately? What do you think you find there? So in the most unlikely but extreme cases, there is even the risk that humanity could lose control of AI completely through the kind of AI sometimes referred to as super intelligence. Personally, we're past that point. You know, there isn't anything they're going to be able to slow it down. It's done. It's history. We just haven't seen have it placed in, or the future. I mean, what it's going to do, but I think it's already there, Dave.
And, certainly painting that picture. Yeah. Here's where I think Sunak might be on the right path in announcing the UK will set up the world's first AI safety institute to evaluate and test new types of AI, mainly to understand their risks. Good thing. I mean, I agree that any company that or any country that hasn't been at the table with AI development is way behind people. There's so much momentum. I mean, there's still lots of issues, technical and otherwise. The ethics of it, I think, is the most important component of AI. And I only wish, that this wasn't ever going to happen anyway. I only wish that some of the leaders around the world, their call for, sort of a pause. Let's slow down. Let's talk about the ethics of this first. Short of ethics per se, I mean, if the UK is focusing on safety for their people, and there's certainly some crossover effect to that among fellow Western-type democracies. Anything that they can create and learn, I'm sure they'll share some of it with each other, particularly as it affects intelligence, that where we're also become so codependent. But this article says that UK has been trying to position itself as a leader in AI safety and in trying to police the new technology. So we will see. China, they invited China to this summit they're holding next week. I'm sure that has raised some eyebrows, but I think it's probably good that they're there.
Well, you're a little more optimistic than I am. I just think of all the corruption in the world, and if there's money to be had, you got these same, I mean, if nobody understands it, you're going to go to the high-tech people, and, you know, it's, oh, they're not going to be totally honest on what they have and so forth. But anyway, I hear the music. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
We may lose and we may win, but we will never be here again. So open up, I'm climbing in. So take it easy.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time today, welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen, Melody taking care of other client business. This final segment, you know where to get her, 1-800-375-4188. She's on the line with other customers. Just leave a message. She's prompt in getting back to you. Hey, there's a good reason why investors are amazed that something hasn't completely broken in the economy yet. Last time U.S. government bond yields climbed this far so fast, the nation plunged in back-to-back recessions. 10-year Treasury yield has jumped more than 4 full percentage points over, well, the past 3 years, pushing it briefly over 5% this week for the first time since 2007. It's the biggest increase since the run-up in the early 80s when Paul Volcker's efforts to slay inflation pushed the 10-year yield to nearly 16%. And that Fed monetary policy set off two consecutive recessions. Now the economy's continued to defy pessimistic forecasts for now, with 4.9% third quarter GDP growth, just one or the latest indication. And policy was more restrictive during the Volcker era. Adjusted for inflation, the real 10-year Treasury yield, or what it paid after inflation. It was around 4% by the time the second downturn of that period started in mid-'81. It's around 1% now. But the surprising economic strength has nevertheless injected large amounts of uncertainty into financial markets here. Bond yields have pushed up sharply over the past several months amid increasing conviction that the Fed will keep interest rates higher for longer. The year began with wide expectations that the bond market would rally as the Fed changed course. Instead, bond prices have kept tumbling. Bloomberg U.S. Treasury Total Index is down about 2.5% so far this year, extending its losses since the peak in August 2020 to 18%. The worst previous peak-to-trough downturn was a decline about 7% in 1980, when the Fed funds rate hit a whopping 20%. We live in uncertain times, ladies and gentlemen. Make sure you own plenty of gold and silver. Hey, I ended Tuesday's program with the observation that with smart people presumably running the White House, Congress, and the Treasury, emphasis on presumably, one is left to wonder, do budget deficits and debt really matter? Well, on this matter, the so-called smart people, Americans largely with good intentions, I think we can say, disagree. On one side, so-called deficit and debt hawks warn that our current borrowing path isn't supportable, especially if rates stay higher for longer. Take interest payments on the debt. Treasury Department reported last week that net interest on our debt increased to a record $659 billion in the government's fiscal year 2023 from $475 billion the year before. The fiscal watchdog Peterson Foundation notes that the $10.6 trillion in projected net interest costs over the next decade would be more than twice as much as what the U.S. has spent on interest over the last 20 years. By 2053, net interest costs are projected to be almost three times the amount the government has historically spent on R&D, infrastructure, and education combined, rising from about 2.5% of GDP as of 2023 to 7.2% by 2053. That's net interest costs. Over the 10 years ending last year, on 2022, excuse me, the U.S. spent more on interest on the debt than it did on a lot of other national priorities. $3 trillion on interest, $2 trillion on education, $1.9 on veteran services, $1.1 trillion on transportation, $400 billion on the environment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's led some experts, like former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, to suggest that the Fed is eventually going to have to weigh in on the government's mountain of debt because of its implications for interest rates. An interesting perspective. Summers says, I understand that the Fed's job is not to get involved in fiscal policy, but I think over time, the Fed's going to have to. We're going to have to engage on some of these questions about our debt. If there's more debt, much bigger deficits, that means more demand in the economy. And that raises the neutral interest rate now and raises even more the prospective neutral rate in the future. Now, the neutral rate, some call it the R star, is the interest rate at which monetary policy neither stimulates nor restricts the economy. The latest Fed projections estimate the neutral rate at 2.5%. Summer sees it in a range of 3.5 to 4. Now, the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget says high and rising national debt will threaten economic growth and the standard of living for all Americans. High debt, it says, will slow the growth of the economy and wages. Plus, it continues, as debt rises, higher interest payments will crowd out important investments in other areas like education, infrastructure, and research that can actually help grow the economy. Getting the debt under control will be very beneficial for generations to come, from higher wages to increased investment to lower borrowing costs for families and business. Now, on the other side is, or I should say was, Nobel laureate and economist Paul Krugman, who says there's no clear case that rising interest rates will hurt the economy, at least in the short run. Krugman added, I still don't think we're facing a fiscal crisis anytime soon, and neither do the markets. If investors were really worried about U.S. solvency, he continues, they would probably expect higher inflation as the federal government turns to the printing press to pay some of its bills. But even if there's no immediate crisis, he adds, high interest rates will almost certainly crowd out private investment, and that will hurt our long-term prospects. Ironically, Krugman spent a large part of the past decade and a half decrying the deficit hawks, who he says hijacked economic debate after the Great Recession, shifting it away from the need to restore full employment. He noted the turn to fiscal austerity caused by this shift in focus did immense harm, leading to millions of person years of lost employment and neglect of important public investments. But he believes there's a big difference between obsessing over the budget deficit in early 2013, say, and believing that we could use a lower deficit now. Back then, the interest rate on bonds protected against inflation risk was negative. So investors, in effect, were paying the federal government to take their money. Well, now that rate's 2.4%, so he says it makes much more sense to be worried about borrowing now. And then there are the modern monetary theorists who argue that governments can spend as necessary on all desirable causes without worrying about paying for it with higher taxes or increased borrowing. Instead, they say using new money from their central banks, such as the Fed, the only limit is if inflation starts to rise, well, the solution is to increase taxes. It was different in the days of the gold standard when the Feds of the world were restrained by a promise to redeem their money for gold on demand. But countries moved away from that system throughout the 20th century, and central banks nowadays generally issue as, or at least they can, most do issue as much money as they'd like. In short, MMT is a school of thought whose central tenets are fiscal deficits don't matter, monetary policy should be subordinate to fiscal policy, and monetary authority should be willing to issue money to finance government spending, period. To the extent that the national debt is held by domestic investors, it constitutes domestic private sector wealth. The implication of this is that increasing the national debt makes individuals feel wealthier. And when this wealth effect is generated by a deficit financed tax cut or transfers, especially in an economic downturn, it can help stimulate private spending, making everyone better off. When the economy is at or near full employment, similar to today, they say, such a policy is instead more likely to increase prices, which can lead to a redistribution of wealth, and not in a way that's good for a majority of people. Together, some say these considerations suggest that we might want to look at the national debt from a different perspective. For them, it's more accurate to view the debt less as a form of debt and more as a form of money in circulation. Investors value treasuries and other securities making up the national debt in the same way individuals value money, as a medium of exchange and a safe store of wealth. The idea of, well, having to pay back money already in circulation makes little sense to them in that context. Of course, not having to worry about paying back the national debt doesn't mean there's nothing to be concerned about. But if the national debt is a form of money, where's the concern? Interesting question. Last week, Jita Gopinath, the first deputy managing director of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, said, fiscal policy is too loose at this point. We think this is the time for fiscal consolidation and to rebuild buffers. Paul Krugman again laments serious deficit reduction, a bad idea a decade ago, is a good idea now, but I see no way to make it happen. Ken Conrad, a senior fellow at the Bipartisan Policy Center, told lawmakers late last week at a hearing about the need for a new commission to study the deficit and debt, quote, I believe we've reached that defining moment. Our fiscal affairs are completely off track. Rising deficits and debt are an economic and national security concern. But geez, another commission, task force, blue ribbon panel, whatever you want to call it. As Melody Cedarstrom would say, are you kidding me? The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities asks, why would some members of Congress consider delegating policy making responsibility to another commission, especially when congressional committees with their deep and broad expertise, referring to staff, are much better suited to the task? The only way to responsibly reduce deficits without slashing investments in people in the economy or turning our back on commitments made in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid is to raise revenues as a central component of any plan. That's again is the Center Budget and Policy Priorities. As they argue, fiscal policy is just fundamentally far more than the difference between revenues and spending. It's about whom and what we invest in, whom and what we leave behind, and how we raise the resources needed to make the investments we value. Now, even if such a high-powered commission could provide political cover for elected members who can cower even in the face of crisis as they do, I'm dubious of its potential impact. The central problem with growing deficits and debt is little more or little less than politics. To make the process work better and for the people, we have to get to the root of the problem by, one, changing the way we finance election campaigns, most importantly by overturning Citizens United, severely limiting lobbying and the free three martini lunches by making it much more transparent, eliminating gerrymandering in the states once and for all, imposing reasonable term limits for all members of Congress as well. And yes, change the way we elect presidents by enacting the National Popular Vote Compact. Controversial, to be sure, but essential, I believe. Until we as a nation fundamentally reform our politics, all this talk about reining in deficits and debt will be just for naught. And if it's for naught, forget about the nation drowning in deficits and debt. Forget about whether climate change is real or not real and whether we're literally drowning and burning our cities and towns. Forget about whether the next Social Security COLA will be 3, 5, or 10%. It will matter little whether our national debt is 100, 150, or 200% of GDP. All that's going to matter is whether our kids and grandkids will be able to manage that big black swan unloading its wrath on life as we know it. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the conclusion of our four-part series on deficits and debt. Hope you found it interesting. Let me know how you feel. And that's all the time we have for today's program. I'll be back next Tuesday, which be here tomorrow to close out the week. Also be on the lookout for our weekly What a Rush of Gold and Silver blog in your email inboxes in the AM. Thanks always to our production engineer, Todd Waite, and to you, loyal listener, for tuning into Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Please be safe out there. Have a good evening. Bye-bye.
I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.